Welcome to the Science Update Podcast. I'm Bob Hirshon, and this is the podcast for June 4th, 2010.
The Science Update Podcast is produced by AAAS, advancing science, serving society.
We take waste, which is expensive to dispose of, and we convert it into a biodegradable plastic.
There already have been many new kinds of organisms that have been created. What's different here is that they have synthesized the entire genome rather than taking existing pieces of natural genomes and stitching them together in new ways.
The thymus is basically the factory for all T cells. That's how the T cell gets its name, T cell. T cells are very important to the immune system, obviously, so it's a good place to sort of look at changes that could be a result of spaceflight or microgravity.
This week, cell phones that can sense dangerous chemicals, a cleaner way to produce hydrogen fuel, and the harmful effects of space on the immune system. But first, Suzanne Bard reports on a new ecologically friendly way to make plastic.
Most plastic is manufactured from petroleum products, and it often ends up polluting the environment.
A lot of it ends up in landfills, but a lot of it doesn't. If you're familiar with the Great Pacific Garbage Patch, it's this island of plastic in the Pacific Ocean that's three times the size of Texas, and it's growing.
That's chemical engineer Ryan Smith of Micromidas, Inc. of Sacramento, California. He and his colleagues have developed a way to transform municipal waste into clean, environmentally friendly plastics.
Sewage actually is composed of a lot of different carbon substrates. There's a lot of proteins that come down the sewer lines, a lot of fats and greases and simple and complex sugars. So instead of doing what the oil companies do, spend a lot of money drilling miles into the earth to pull carbon out of the substrata, what we do is we talk to people who are very eager to get rid of all these carbonaceous, what they call wastes, and what we call a feedstock.
Smith says microorganisms are the key to the process.
So there's all this carbon actually available, and it's not being utilized. And so what we've done is we found microbes that are good at utilizing it, and they actually convert the carbon in the waste. They actually use it as an energy storage mechanism where they store little granules of essentially biodegradable plastic in their body. And we harvest the cells and pull the plastic out and actually use it for processing and turning it into containers.
He says products made from the material are completely safe for consumer use.
It runs through a series of biochemical processes and then chemical post-treatment so that it's as clean as any plastic you and I have ever used. But there's sort of this psychological hurdle to get over. But what a lot of us don't realize is that the plastic we always use is derived from crude oil. I don't know if you've ever seen crude in its raw form, but it's absolutely disgusting. It stinks, it's gross, it's icky, and it's something that no one even thinks twice about. So I think the fact that what we're ultimately doing is actually cleaning up the environment sort of outweighs that sort of psychological hurdle.
And he's hopeful that the new plastic will one day replace the more polluting kind.
Our final goal is essentially to replace all the disposable plastics that you and I use every day, like with water bottles, forks, packaging. And instead of having that plastic end up in a landfill or even worse, the environment, and just accumulating at this rapid rate that we see, is to actually derive plastics from waste streams and have those plastics be biodegradable. We wanted to tackle the problem actually at its source, and that really means creating a plastic that's completely biodegradable. If our plastic ends up in the ocean, it just sinks and degrades within about a year. Likewise, if it ends up in a landfill or a composting heap, it completely degrades within about a year's time. You could mulch it and spread it on your garden. It's that safe.
Smith adds that since the plastic is derived from a readily available source, the manufacturing costs can be kept low.
Right now, a very large percentage of all the costs in producing plastic as it's made from petroleum products is the feedstock. And likewise, there are other efforts to make bioplastics that are based on corn feedstocks and sugar feedstocks, but those are very expensive. And so what we're going to, essentially a negative cost feedstock, that drives our costs of operation very low and allows us to compete ultimately with the petroleum plastics that you and I are used to.
He says the process is very efficient and uses most of the waste that's received from waste treatment plants.
Thanks, Suzanne. When danger is literally in the air, be it from a gas leak or a chemical attack, it's crucial to spot it as soon as possible. But that would require installing chemical sensors all over the place. Our New York correspondent, Justin Warner, looked into a potentially better solution.
Imagine a global network of chemical sensors that constantly check the air for toxins. Building something like that from the ground up would be hugely expensive and difficult. That's why the Department of Homeland Security wants to put chemical sensors like that in cell phones. They've funded a California company called Revision to work on the idea, and they've collaborated with the University of California at San Diego to develop the sensor. UCSD biochemist Michael Saylor says it's a thumbnail-sized flake of silicon. Nano-sized pores in the silicon can be engineered to respond to different chemicals.
Either chemicals that might be coming out of an industrial accident, a homeland security kind of an event, a terrorist event, for example, or even something as simple as carbon monoxide in a conventional fire.
The chemical would make the relevant pores on the sensor change color, and that color change is detected by a digital camera smaller than the head of a pencil eraser. Saylor says the resolution of today's cell phone cameras is high enough to track a million different spots on the sensor simultaneously. The information can then be relayed to any other phone, computer, or processing station in order to alert the authorities.
With the network, it allows you to do things that a single element sensor can't do, such as tracking a plume. Multiple cell phones are responding simultaneously in a certain region. You can kind of get an idea of where the cloud is going.
DHS is going to start by distributing sensor-equipped phones to certain police, firefighters, and other first responders. But eventually, the sensor could become a standard feature in phones sold to the public.
Thanks, Justin. Imagine getting a powerful, clean fuel from seawater. That's a step closer to reality, say researchers at the University of California at Berkeley and Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. They've improved a technique for extracting clean-burning hydrogen gas from water. Postdoctoral researcher Hemamala Karundasa says that today's techniques aren't practical because they use precious metals like platinum as catalysts.
There are two main problems with this. One is that these metals are extremely expensive, and also metals like platinum get deactivated very easily.
But her team discovered a metal catalyst that's 70 times cheaper than platinum and actually works better. And unlike platinum, it works even in dirty seawater, which is one resource that the Earth has no shortage of.
Next, you've probably heard recently that scientists at the J. Craig Venter Institute have created a synthetic genome, or set of genetic instructions that tell a cell what to do. I spoke with Reed College philosopher and scientist Mark Badeau this week about the nature of synthetic life and the ethical implications of creating a genome from the ground up. I asked him if this really represents a new form of life.
What the Venter group has created in the lab is a bacterium that has a prosthetic genome. It's really only a partly synthetic cell. The part that they've synthesized is the genome, and that, of course, contains a lot of instructions for how the cell behaves, so it's a really important part, but they certainly have not synthesized the whole cell, and no one right now knows how to do that. There are other people working very hard right now to make fully synthetic cells in which the whole entire entity created would be made out of raw materials that you buy from a chemical supply house.
Badeau says that creating synthetic genomes in organisms could have potential benefits for medicine. For example, it might be possible to use the technology to create new vaccines or even fight tumors. Another area of promise is in environmental cleanup.
Right now, naturally existing bacteria or slightly genetically modified bacteria sometimes are used today to clean up, for example, oil spills. In fact, if you just let an oil spill happen, like this horrible one that's happening in the Gulf today, eventually the microorganisms that live in the Gulf are going to digest it all and break it all down. That'll take a long time, though. And, of course, there'll be unimaginable, horrible consequences in the meantime. But it will happen. So what people are talking about doing is making synthetic organisms, or at least organisms with synthetic genomes, that would break down at least some of the products in oil spills much more fast. People are thinking about this right now. They can see that that would be a very different step from making something which exists only in a laboratory or only in industrial containers. They want to do this at some point if they can do it in a way that's safe. And people are thinking hard right now about how to do this in a responsible way, you know, how to build in the right kinds of safeguards.
He says that while synthesizing a whole genome is new, scientists have been manipulating genes for a long time.
For example, human insulin has been produced by bacteria for many years by just putting the gene for creating human insulin into bacteria and then having big vats of bacteria whose one job in life is just to produce insulin all day long. Or people might have heard of glowfish. These are fish you buy for your aquarium, but they put in a gene which causes them to glow in the dark like fireflies. And so the fish actually glow in your tank. You can go to the store and buy these today. So there already have been many new kinds of organisms that have been created. What's different here is that they have synthesized the entire genome rather than taking existing pieces of natural genomes and stitching them together in new ways.
Bedeau adds that many guidelines are already in place to regulate genetically modified organisms. He says that scientists, governments, and regulatory organizations are working together to develop additional safeguards for organisms created from synthetic genomes.
It's striking and notable that on the same day that the Venture Team paper was released, the White House released a request to the Presidential Committee for the Safety of Bioethical Issues to take as their first order of business a study of the implications of this work. So already the U.S. government is actively working on thinking about what kinds of regulations are needed.
Bedeau says the synthetic genome is a useful new tool for understanding how the cell works.
And the potential benefits of this are, I think, huge.
Thanks, Suzanne. Speaking of synthetic life, there's a big demand now for synthetic antibodies, which are used in medicine and basic research. Now Stefan Johnston of Arizona State University's Biodesign Institute and his colleagues have found an easier way to make them. Rather than inject an animal with a target protein and wait for antibodies to form, Johnston's team used a library of 8,000 possible target proteins, all packed on a single slide.
We said, what if we just sort of made a synthetic antibody, just arbitrarily make one, and then throw it on the slide and see what it binds to, and let what it binds to be its target?
This turned out to be surprisingly efficient. One antibody they produced binds to AKT1, a protein linked to obesity, cancer, and aging. Antibodies like these help researchers locate, isolate, and analyze a protein so they can figure out what it actually does. Finally today, if humans are ever going to explore further into space, for example, a manned mission to Mars, they'll have to guard against the hazards of long-term spaceflight. Justin Warner reports on why astronauts' immune systems might need an extra boost.
Some health risks of long-term spaceflight are well known, the loss of muscle mass and bone density, for example. Now there's evidence that astronauts' immune systems may weaken in space as well. This according to University of Arizona immunologist Ty Lebsack. He and his colleagues studied mice that had been flown in space. Compared to matched Earthbound mice, the astromice showed significant changes in the regulation of 12 genes in the thymus gland.
The thymus is basically the factory for all T cells. That's how the T cell gets its name, T cell. And it is used to educate and manufacture T cells in the body. T cells are very important to the immune system, obviously. So it's a good place to sort of look at changes that could be a result of spaceflight or microgravity.
Lebsack says many of the changes relate to programmed cell death. One possible upshot is that they could disrupt the thymus's quality control system, making it kill off healthy T cells along with defective ones. In fact, prior lab studies have found that T cell death increases in simulated microgravity. Exactly how much this would affect astronauts' health remains to be seen. So far, astronauts haven't seemed to get sick more than expected, but Lebsack says that could change as space flights get much longer.
Thanks, Justin. Well, that's all we have for you this week. Next week, we'll have a whole new set of intriguing science stories for you. But if you can't wait that long, you can get your daily dose of science by listening to the Science Update Podcast Daily Edition every day, Monday through Friday. You can find it on our website, scienceupdate.com, or at iTunes. You can also check out Science Update's fan page on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. And if you have a science question, give us a call at 1-800-WHY-IS-IT. If we use your question, we'll send you a Science Update mug. Thanks for listening. I'm Bob Hirshon for AAAS, the Science Society.